Hello, everybody. I'm an alcoholic. My name's Keith. By God's grace, Alcoholics Anonymous, rooms full of people like you, and a little bit of effort on my own, it hasn't been necessary for me to take a drink or do any dope since May the 11th, 1976, and for that I'm forever grateful. It's a privilege for me to be here tonight fully clothed and in my right mind. And I want to thank the committee for inviting me. It's always a privilege to be a part of Alcoholics Anonymous, and it's always a special treat to be able to spend some time with some people that that you've known in the program and don't get to spend much time with anymore. It's special. I have friends today, not just acquaintances, and that's different because when I got to Alcoholics Anonymous, I run out of friends and enemies at the same time. So, you know, it's a special thing. And I'm always aware of my gratitude for my sobriety anytime I get an opportunity to participate in my own recovery. And I have a lot of feelings for that. You know, the big book of Alcoholics Anonymous tells us we're supposed to share what it used to be like, what happened, and what it's like today, which is basically sharing our experience, our strength, and our hope. And I don't know anything else. I'm not an authority on alcoholism. I'm not an authority on anything other than total destruction of my life and anybody that happened to be around me. I didn't come to Alcoholics Anonymous with an original thought. Everything I know I got from people like you in rooms like this. I'm a thief, and I stole everything I got. It's my greatest asset today. And it's a special feeling within me of gratitude that I have had a good foundation of sobriety. I'm grateful that I have had opportunities to be with people in Alcoholics Anonymous, or the willingness to find people in Alcoholics Anonymous who live this program as a way of life. I drank alcohol until I achieved pitiful, incomprehensible demoralization, bought myself a bag of dope and a Harley Davidson, and became a legend in my own mind. And I know there's some other legends in here because you can always feel them. Yeah. They're the one with all the answers to all the questions. And I heard my story when I was new in Alcoholics Anonymous. If you're new or relatively new and you haven't heard your story, I hope you can get some identity. I used to drink a little beer and think maybe I ought to do something. And then I'd smoke a little of that weed and kind of fantasize how I was going to do it. And I'd shoot some of that speed so I had the strength to do whatever it was I was going to do. Now I'd snort a little of that coke so I could be cool when I did it. And then I'd drink a little whiskey and forget what the hell it was I was going to do. So I'm a pig. I don't identify with anybody that's specialized. There isn't anything I didn't try to do or want to do or did. I'm grateful for that because when I got to Alcoholics Anonymous, I don't sit around here and wonder about those kind of things. I did it all. I did a lot of speed. I'm a speed freak. That's like going 150 miles an hour with your feet nailed to the floor. And my biggest fear was that my body was going to die and my head was going to keep on living. But I ultimately became a walking encyclopedia of worthless information is what I became, and hell, I thought I was a book of knowledge. So it's what you learn after you know all the answers and everything that counts, you know. So, but I do have some character defects that have caused me a lot of pain, and I know pain. But the one that has caused me the most pain is that you can line 10 women up against that wall over there and I'll get the sickest one every time. I mean, I love sick women. There's something about a sick woman that just, there's a certain kind of insanity and attraction that you just know that it's going to be fantastic and it's going to be exciting. And besides that, if you do a lot of speed, you don't have time to pack. And you need somebody that just goes with it, you know? And my first wife, she wasn't sick. Her daddy was one of the 10 richest men in the state of Texas, and he didn't get that way because he made bad investments, and after 9 months of that marriage, they called me in and just told me that I was a bad investment, and they throwed me away. I was born in a Texas panhandle, and that's not character defect, but some places it's a crime. And, My daddy's an alcoholic. I'm a fourth generation alcoholic, and I didn't look any farther than that. That was all I wanted to look. My daddy is a sober member of Alcoholics Anonymous. I have 14 months of seniority on him. I don't ever let him forget it. But he's just my old man. He's just my old man. You know, and that's the rigorous honesty that the book talks about. He's just my old man. That's all I ever wanted. And we have that relationship today. He's been able to put his arms around me and say, I love you, son. And that's the simplicity of those things. He was a lawyer. I always needed a lawyer. And I told him, I said, you know, it always seemed to me like when you talked to me, you were interrogating me. And he said, I was. You know, and my grandpappy was an alcoholic. He was a devil-may-care chap. He was a gambler. He drank and used dope till he was 89 years old. When you're 89 years old, you drink a little whiskey and then chew a little dope, and then forget you shot a little dope and drank a little whiskey, and then drink a little more whiskey and chew a little more dope, and you die while you're not some hip, slick, cool dope fiend. You're just some old fart run the end of his rope, and there wasn't no knot there, you know? I guarantee you one thing, that old man left a note in his boots that says it takes a hell of a man to fill his pappy's boots, and he wasn't kidding, because I couldn't make her to 89. And I don't ever remember them people telling me that I'll drink like them, and that's good, because I never wanted to drink like them. I don't know if I remember being different. I'm sure there's emotions. I believe I was an alcoholic from the get-go. I don't know if I was born an alcoholic, but I know when I took my first drink, an alcoholic was born. So it really doesn't make any difference. I'm not a victim of their circumstances, because I didn't stay around them that long, and they were glad of that. I do remember on occasions them having me sitting in front of them, and they were saying things like, we love you, why do you do these things? And I didn't have any answers for that. I didn't know why. You know, it was just a thing to do. Because you see, the big book of Alcoholics Anonymous tells me the men and women drink essentially for the effect, and the effect after some period of time is that you cannot distinguish the difference between right or wrong, true or false. And I look for that magic feeling from the moment of my first drink until I took my last drink. And I would still be out there drinking if it would work. I did it so well that there were psychiatrists that had me labeled as a sociopath, someone with no conscience. And I'm glad to report to you that I'm not a sociopath, I'm just an alcoholic. And that is a saving grace, because I do have a conscience, and the conscience that I know today is a direct result of this program and the steps and loving people as an example. But I was standing around a little country dance one Saturday night, not doing nothing. And when I wasn't doing nothing, I wasn't doing nothing. And about midnight, whenever they'd have intermission in that band and take break, then people I lived around, they'd either fiddle, whittle, or diddle, and I didn't have nothing going for me, and I'd look around, there'd be other guys leaning up against that wall just like me, and I'd take a coke bottle and roll it down the dance floor and say, let the meanest son of a bitch in the house bring it back. And it looked like a stampede coming my direction. And I had a philosophy, I don't know, must have been something I had from the very beginning, if you're stupid enough to lead the charge, I'm going to hit you quick and split. Because I'm not one of those guys that lost a lot of fights. Because I didn't stay around until they were over. That's the key to that. I don't know about you, you stayed around, but I split. And at that time, I was hiding in the woman's restroom. And I hit this guy and took off running to the woman's restroom, and there was a blonde-headed lady standing there by the door, and I said, tell me when the fight's over. And I run in the woman's restroom, and I didn't realize it, but she finished the fight. And then she come in there and said, you can come out now, cowboy. And I said, well, you did so well, how about a dance? Now, I'm a quick study. It don't take me long to find out what I need to know. In one quick dance, I found out she had a job, she had an apartment, she had money in the bank, she had a driver's license, she had a car. She didn't have no man in her life, and I fell in love immediately. Met all requirements. The state of Texas had taken my driver's license away forever. I just got out of a penitentiary for an 18-month term down there in Texas for something that I was a victim of circumstances for. I didn't have a job. I didn't have no money or a place to go. And I know we didn't fall in love immediately. We fell in sick with each other, because the rocks in my head fit the holes in hers. And she was just looking for somebody to fix. Now, I know an obsession for alcohol and narcotics, but I also know an obsession of the being the obsessed. And that woman was obsessed with me. I mean, that's true paranoia. You know somebody is for sure thinking about you. When you got one of them? And we dated for a period of time, and after a period of time, she gave me an ultimatum. I didn't want to rush into nothing. I didn't have any more going for me after that period of time than I did when I first met her. And so we got married. And after a period of time, she said she was pregnant and said I was the father. And I didn't understand anything about that, I'll guarantee you. Didn't even know if that was true, but at that time I was willing to take any kind of an attention. And along with all those kind of responsibilities come responsibilities. And I don't like responsibilities because responsibilities get in the way of my drinking. And I didn't understand anything about that. I don't know anything about being a husband or a father or employee. I just know about doing my thing because I'm selfish. And I know today that I'm willing to try to adjust myself to various environments. I've always been able to do that. Because we're a master of disguises and personalities. That was kind of fun until you had to go to work. And she had this little girl, and I had to get a house, and I had to, you know, do them things that they tell you got to do, and we had to get a dog and a cat. Now, I'm one of them guys can go over to your house, pick a dog out of the litter, and I'll get the craziest dog every time. They'll send me after the Easter bunny, and I get the one with ringworm. I don't know, you know, I went over and got this dog, and this dog growed up to be a 120-pound German Shepherd dog and hated me. I took him to obedience class, and we both got thrown out of obedience class. I said, there's no hope, you know. And we got this cat, and one morning, full of guilt and remorse, they sent me down to get this cat neutered. And I don't know what that vet did to her, but it pissed her off, and I should have had her declawed. I'm one of them guys that will tell my wife, I'm going to go have two beers. Just two beers. What I should have said is I'm going to go have two beers and go to jail. But of course, we never said that. And after a period of time, it became necessary for me to leave Texas. That'll happen to you if you stay around there long enough. In Alcoholics Anonymous, they call that a geographic, but in Texas, they call it unlawful flight to avoid prosecution. You got to get the hell out of Texas. A guy offered me a job in California, so we loaded up and went to California, and that's a story in itself, because most people could make that trip in 3 days, only took us 30. And I got arrested just as soon as I hit California, because I took me with me. But I looked up a drunken uncle, and he got me a house, and it was just perfect for me. It was a house nobody lived in for a couple of years, and a bunch of dope fiends lived on one side, and motorcycle gang lived on another, and all the Christians lived across the street. I mean, that's part of the deal, because I got to have me a place where I can sit over on my side of the turf and look over on their side of the turf, and you get the right combination going while you can say, I'm just like them. They had the dichondra lawns, and they had all the good deals, you know, jobs and cars and all those things. I'd sit over there and get loaded and just think, yeah, I'm just like them. And my wife was yelling and screaming at me all the time. I mean, it's like her mouth was attached to the doorknob, man. I mean, I'd go off and work, and I worked in the oil fields, and I'd be gone 5 or 6 weeks or 5 or 6 months, whatever. I'd come home, and there she'd be, man. I'd open that door, and there she'd be, just talk, 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 yelling and screaming. I swear to God, I could never get her to shut up. I like guns. Guns will enhance conversation. You can shoot a .44 mag off next to somebody's ear, and they'll pay attention to you. They won't hear nothing, but they'll pay attention to you. If that woman wasn't afraid, I'd stick a .38 right in her mouth, and she just kept talking. She just took up carrying a butcher knife and stick that butcher knife right in my stomach. One time I hit my gun right on her nose, man. I said, you're crazy. She said, you go first. I said, if I shoot you, how do you figure that? She said, well, if you shoot me, the momentum will knock me back, and I'll gut you on the way back. Now, you know, samurai warriors, they train all their life to be able to do that, and the pre-Al-Anon knows that intuitively. You know? I pride myself in being able to choke somebody right up to the brink of death. You can watch their face turn a color, and their eyes will glaze over, and that woman would get right in my mouth, shaking that finger, yelling and screaming at me, and I'd tell her, get out of my face. She'd take one step closer. I told her to get out of my face again. She'd take another step closer. I'd get my hands around her neck, and I'd choke her right up to that point that her eyes would glaze over. And I didn't know till after I come to the program she went down on that her only obsession was me. All she ever wanted was 100% of my attention. And you know that when I was choking her to death, she knew that the only thing on my mind was her. She was willing to go to anything. Hell, she was getting off on that. If I'd have known she was getting off on it, I wouldn't have done it. I'd go off and do my thing, and I'd come home, she'd be crazy in hell, and I'd have to get it calmed down, and I'd be out there. I was out in the garage one day drinking a little beer, and my neighbor across the street come over and said, "I'd like to paint your house." I said, "Oh, what color?" "So I don't know, whatever color you want." And I said, "Well, I don't know. I've been trying to paint it for 4 or 5 years. One end's blue, one side's green." I mean, my attention span wasn't too long, you know, and I lost interest in things. I said, "If you can figure out a color, I'll let you paint it." And he did, and he did. And my wife come out there and said, "You know, what's he doing?" And I said, "He's painting my house. Hell, they're working for me." I asked him, I said, "Why do you want to paint my house?" He said, "Well, I'm going to put mine up for sale across the street. I'm going to get the hell out of the neighborhood before your side infects mine, you know. I want to clean your side up, you know." And he did. He painted my house. And then he come over and take the old cars out of the front yard. Now, that's different because I had a four-door Edsel and a Corvair out there that were antiques. So I said, that was my backstop, man. I'd come drunk down the street ricocheting off everything. When I hit one of them cars, I knew I was home. And I said, "You know, if you take them cars out of there, I'm liable to run off the end of the earth." He said, "No, I'll pay for it. I'll take them out." And I got to thinking, "Well, I got a friend who's got an old boat looking for a place to put it someplace. We'll let him move the cars, get out of the neighborhood, and then we'll put the boat in there." And we did. We parked that boat right in my front yard, man. I caught a lot of fish off the back of that boat, man. I mean, you sit out there and get loaded and shoot the fireworks on Christmas Eve that you didn't get to shoot on the 4th of July because you were in jail, you know what I mean? I'd have to leave. I always had to leave. Maybe coming or going. And I'd have to come back home, and always she wanted me to do all these things. She always had all these things. I'd get home and I'd have to get her calmed down, get it all settled down, lay down, because I'd come home to rest. You know, I was tired. Didn't know what I'd been doing, but I was tired. Wake right up. Because I wake up quick. I mean, I wake up quick. Jump right up and run out to the kitchen and get something to get my heart started. Get about 100 mini bennies, throw them in a blender, a couple of raw eggs, some orange juice, a little something to get you well. Pour me a big glass of vodka, hit it a couple of times with Tabasco sauce so I can call it a Bloody Mary, drink that, chase the other, and be 4:30, 5 o'clock in the morning, and you get that idea. Well, I ought to do something. I go out in the garage. I think I'll mow my front yard. I always like to mow my front yard at 5 o'clock in the morning. I didn't have a front yard. I had front dirt. I like front dirt. If you got front dirt, you don't have to use a grass catcher, you know. My lawnmower never had a muffler on it because I wanted everybody to know I was mowing my front yard. You get out in the garage, get that stuff going 2 inches behind your belly button, looking at that lawnmower, and you finally find that lawnmower. Oh, man, there's my lawnmower. But you don't have a rope. Don't worry, man. You can push start that sucker when that stuff goes off in your belly. I get around the front yard and start mowing my front dirt and slinging stuff everywhere. One morning, my mower died. I got a philosophy. I must have brought it from Texas. I don't know. If it don't run, kill it. I blowed a hole with my lawnmower one morning, 5 o'clock in the morning, with a 44 mag out there. And the cops come and want to talk to me about that. They want to run my head into their nightstick 5 or 6 times, too. And then she'd come out and tell him, "Don't take him away because he's got all these things to do. The steel don't work. The sink don't work." And I'm thinking, "They'll take me away. I'd be safer with you." Go back in the house, get a little depressed, because what goes up has got to come down. I had an old chair in my house I always used to lay in, man, just riding over recliner, and I could drink a little red wine, kind of mellow out, and sinks just a little bit into a depression. You don't want to go all the way into a depression because that's dangerous. I had an old Winchester 97 shotgun down underneath that chair, and I'd get her out, play with it a little bit. Her and the kid and the dog and the cat line up over on their line of contempt. Look at you with that sad look. "Oh, you're a sick son of a bitch." I'd jack that old gun back, stick the barrel in my mouth, and click the trigger. It was empty, of course, because I wasn't going to commit suicide until the crowd got there. One time I jacked it back and seen some red go by. I thought, "I don't know what that was." I pulled over and clicked that trigger. The gun went off. That bitch put a shell in that gun, tried to kill me. Blowed the air conditioner, plumb out of the wall, man. It was out there flying around. We had a hell of a fight. It was July. Cops come, run my head into the nightstick 5 or 6 times. Get it calmed down again, you know. Don't feed neighbors to come over and call the cops pigs all the time. I said, don't call the cops pigs when they're beating on me. I don't do that to you. Get it calmed down. But I got to get out of here, you know. You got to make the great escape. I usually had trouble with my car by the time I got home, and she's the only one that had one to run, and I'd make the great escape. Run, get her purse, grab her keys, run out, get in her car, start her car, back down the driveway, turn around, be sure you don't hit nobody, look back, and there she'd be on the hood, man. I don't know if there's any hood riders in here or not, but a crazy woman on a hood will sober you up, man. I mean, oh, jeez. Got to drive back up the driveway, drag her off the hood, the dog's biting in the ass, the cat's scratching, the kid's bawling. Then they send that van with a sports coat that ties in the back. I never was cool in one of them straitjackets. Two things I never could do there. I never could break handcuffs or be cool in a straitjacket. Then they take me down there to the nut ward. They'd been there and tie me down and put me on one of them tables in 4-point restraint. And I'd lay there and yell and scream. One time I thought, I don't know why I'm screaming. I stopped screaming. I listened. Hell, everybody else was tied down and screaming. I didn't want to be different. I go over there to that phone. They let me call her up and say, you got me in the nut ward one more time. You got to get me out of the nut ward. I'm going to kill you. And she'd hang up, and I'd tear the phone off the wall in the nut ward. That's good for 72 more hours of observation. One time I was in that nut ward, and I thought, you know, they're getting to know me here. I got to have a story. These psychiatrists had me in there, and they was talking to me. I said, I know what it was. I was in the big war. I was a paratrooper, and they took me through this deal, and then they took me out here in this place, and then they put me in this airplane, and they put this stuff on my back and took me up in this airplane, I don't know, 15, 20,000 feet, and everybody started jumping out of that airplane, and I got up the door and I froze. Some guy shoved me. I fell, I don't know, 15, 20,000 feet. I landed in a tree. My chute didn't open. Flung me over there. I lit on my head. Some people come and got me and took me over here, and then they got me and took me over there, and then they brought me back and put me in this hospital, and this doctor gave me the little pills, and when I take these little pills and drink whiskey, I go crazy. One in psychiatrist said, just a minute. He went in there and called up my wife and said, you know, he's in the wrong hospital. He ought to be down at the VA hospital. And she said, what for? He's never been in the service. I said, Jesus, man. This one I had a good story, you know. They come back and talk to me about my mother, and I talk to them about their mother, and that's good for 72 more hours of observation. They gave me a little card that said I was crazy and I could come back anytime I wanted to and stick it in their slot and let myself in. Now, I knew better than that because ain't no doorknobs on them sides. But it did impress my friends. When you got a card that says you're crazy, they'll give you names like psycho and animal. I don't know what upgrades what, but I mean, it impressed them. I was a card-carrying nut. And that's when I was a social drinker. I don't consider anything prior to coming to Alcoholics Anonymous being an alcoholic, but, I came to Alcoholics Anonymous. I came to Alcoholics Anonymous because I was standing in front of a judge, and he's talking to me about the things I've been doing. He had the right guy. And he's talking to me about going back to penitentiary for 3 to 5 years, and I didn't want some of that. Somewhere in the midst of that conversation, he talked to me about going to Alcoholics Anonymous. Now, I didn't know anything about Alcoholics Anonymous, but I knew something about what the alternative was, and I made a deal with him, and I said, you know, he's talking about this AA thing. I said, may I try it, you know? We're humble when we're in that position. We're willing, too. And he gave me a number, and he told me about a meeting of Alcoholics Anonymous, and I went home, and I told her, I said, I got to go to a meeting of Alcoholics Anonymous tonight, 8:30 to 10, right over here in church. I laid down, and I'm thinking about it. About 8 o'clock, she come over and stuck that butcher knife right in my face. She said, get up. I said, where are we going? She said, we're going to that A&A meeting. Cops had taken all my guns away. I didn't have a choice, so I got up and I went over there to A&A. There was a church. Had the A&A sign outside. I thought, Jesus, I've sunk to the bottom now, you know. She said, what time's that meeting over? I said, 10 o'clock. She said, I'm going to tell you something, fat boy. If your ass comes through that door before 10, I'm going to gut you. Said, you can keep a drunk like me sober. You got a crazy woman out there in the car with a butcher knife, I'll guarantee you. And I stayed in that meeting of Alcoholics Anonymous. I went to one meeting a week for 4 months. Most miserable time of my life. There ain't nothing worse than being a meeting of Alcoholics Anonymous if you're not really, really, I mean really an alcoholic. You ain't really an alcoholic, I mean really an alcoholic. You ain't really an alcoholic. And they're talking about steps and sponsorship and meetings and all that stuff. And I mean, if you ain't really, by God, really an alcoholic, you ain't really an alcoholic. And lady thing happened to me. I go into one meeting a week for 4 months. I looked around one day. 4 months had passed. I beat that deal at the courthouse. Had a good parole officer. I was sitting in my house looking around. And I looked in the kitchen. There she was, fat and happy. I'm back in the big bedroom. The old dog's laying down there next to me. I pet the dog. He's smiling at me. The cat's in my lap purring. Pat the kid on the head over here. I thought, hell, I've been too hard on myself. I've prematurely gone to Alcoholics Anonymous. I know someday I'll be over there, but I'll be old. And I resigned from Alcoholics Anonymous. You see, because I proved that the first step didn't apply to me. I proved, going to one meeting a week for 4 months, that now, I knew I was powerless over alcohol, but I knew these guys had these tie sticks. And they said, if you don't drink alcohol and smoke these tie sticks, well, you won't get in trouble. I said, what do? And they said, well, we hang around the park and wait for the ice cream truck to come by. I thought, I never wanted to hang around the park and wait for the ice cream truck to come by. I wanted to rob that sucker, man. But it sounded good to me, and I proved my life was not unmanageable. The amazing thing happened to me. I got struck drunk immediately, if not sooner. And there's nothing cute or funny about the next 4 years of my life. There's nothing cute or funny about it all. Because there ain't nothing worse than being out there and having a belly full of booze and arm full of dope and head full of AA. Makes you angry. And you know that it won't work for you. And I know that I know. But there is a part in that book that it says we must hear. And I hear a lot of people talk about what it used to be like. And what it's like today. And there's some built-in thing because we don't remember the things we don't want to remember. But it also says that we got to share what happened. But what happened to me is the most significant thing about that deal. And I know that the alcoholic ego is an unbelievable thing. And we have to do exactly what we got to do. In the 12 and 12, in the next last paragraph, the first step, it said an alcoholic must hit a bottom. They must hit a bottom before they are willing to do what's necessary to be done the next 11 steps. And I know today that there is some bottom below which you cannot go, but you must go. Because what it says you got to do in the next 11 steps is contradictory to anything an alcoholic, drinking, drunk ever want to do, because it says in the second step you got to admit you're crazy. You know, and there's some power can destroy you. I said, you can't come back from someplace you've never been. You know, and then it says you got to make a decision, turn your will and your life over to some power greater than yourself, God. I mean, I've been prayed on, prayed over, sprinkled, dipped, baptized, and dunked, and it didn't work for me. I knew that wasn't going to work. I was an atheist. Didn't even know what it was. Said it was. Then it says the stupidest thing I've heard. Said in that fourth step. Says you got to write this stuff down, sign it, and go give it to somebody. My lawyers have been telling me forever, for God's sakes, don't write it down. Above all, don't sign it, and don't tell nobody none of that stuff. And then it says you got character defects that have character, and then it says you got to become aware of them, and then you got to turn them over to God. All my character defects have character. And then it says the stupidest thing I've heard. You got to make a list of all the people that wronged you and you wrong. I knew if you had anything to do with me, you had to be a little bit wrong. It wasn't all my fault. Why do I got to make a list like that? I mean, I don't care if I'm 95% wrong and you're 5% wrong. I don't even care if I'm 99% wrong and you're 1% wrong. You're wrong. You're wrong. You're wrong. Why do I got to do that? Then it says you got to pray and meditate and promptly admit. And look at yourself. I did thousands of dollars worth of narcotics and alcohol to keep from looking at myself. I would be damned if I want to do something that's going to make me look at me every day. And besides that, every time I meditated, I slipped into a sexual fantasy. And then it says the stupidest thing I ever heard. You got to go give it away. I don't know anybody who wants to give nothing away when you're out there doing your thing. So see, it's necessary to hit some bottom. And I know my bottom was my bottom. And my experience is mine. I share a little bit of it with you so that you might know what has been necessary for me to switch my obsession. I switched my obsession from drinking and using to this program. It's a magnificent obsession. There's a certain amount of willingness there that has been with me since I've come to Alcoholics Anonymous for myself. It is a gift. Because of myself, I do not have the power to do that nor the willingness. But I do have my past experiences. And the big book of Alcoholics Anonymous says that our past is our greatest asset. My past is my greatest asset, not yours. And I know many, many days. Not one day, not one week, not one month, but years. And I recall one morning standing in my kitchen, and I'm taking a hit off a bottle of hot vodka, and I look down the hallway, and a little 9-year-old girl standing down at the end of that hallway. She's got her chin on her chest, and her hair is in her face, and she's got an old coat on. And she's been down there in the room down at the end of that hallway, and she has no friends, she has no enemies. Got a couple of old brown bags, everything she's got her in those bags, and she went someplace and got an Easter egg and rolled around in her pocket and got in the lining of that coat, and she sat on it, and she looked and smelled like she looked and smelled. And she was looking at me, and I was looking at her. I took it out of that jug and looked down that hallway one more time. She didn't run down that hallway and say, "Daddy, will you come out and play with me today?" She didn't say, "Daddy, will you please don't beat me and Mommy?" She looked at me, and I looked at her, and I turned around and took another hit off that jug, and she was gone. She was just looking to see which way I was going, so she'd go the other way. Well, I remember one morning, I don't know what time it was, 6:30, 7 o'clock in the morning, I'm standing in that bathroom, and I cooked up some of that stuff and got it in that syringe, and I turned around and getting ready to slam it in my arm. Just for a second, my eyes caught a little 9.5-year-old girl looking at me through the crack in that door. And we looked at each other in that mirror, and I knew I was just what I thought I was. I knew beyond a shadow of a doubt it had me, I didn't have it. She didn't say, "Daddy, please come out and play with me today." She didn't say, "Please don't beat me and Mommy." She looked at me, and I looked at her, and I turned around and did what I had to do, and without a sound, she was gone. She was just looking to see which way I was going, so she'd go the other way. I know many days. I know that in the last 4 years of my drinking and using, I was arrested 57 times for assault and battery and resisting arrest, and 31 of those times had to do with me beating my wife and my daughter so bad physically that they were hospitalized or could not get out of the house. I don't tell you that to tell you or to impress you. I tell you that because my sponsors told me that I must never forget where I come from. It's a simple fact that I should never sit in a meeting of Alcoholics Anonymous unless somebody else share their story and think that I was different. To know beyond a shadow of a doubt that if I were to pick up that drink, I'd go right back. And I wouldn't be that funny drunk sitting on a bar stool telling funny jokes. I'd be that violent animal. You know, you can take everything away from a human being. Everything. Money, property, prestige, people, places, and things. You can take it away from a human being. And they'll still be a human being. But once we lose our dignity, we got nothing left to lose, and we're as near an animal that a human being can be. And I sold my soul. In so doing, I lost my dignity. I know what it's like to stand in front of a judge in a little town in Nevada. And he's talking to me about me. And he's got the right guy. He's talking to me about the fact that I've been in a fight. And he said, "You know, you look like an animal, you think like an animal, you live like an animal. And when you live and look and act that way and you smell that way and you run with people like that, you got to defend yourself like an animal." But he said, "I know that the man that you were in a fight with, he lost his life. And he's just like you, and he probably deserved to die. But what I don't understand is how you can beat another human being with your hands, with your bare hands, for 10 or 15 minutes after it's obvious to anyone, that he was dead, that there was no life left in him." And I wanted to scream out at that man, "The wrong man died. It should have been me that died. You see, I'm trying to die. I got shortchanged. I got to live." And he called me the scum of the earth, and he let me walk out of that deal. And I never served a day, but I lived in a nightmare for another 2 years. Many times I'd wake up in the middle of the night, sometimes in my own home, and jump straight up out of that bed and run down the hallway and look in a bedroom where a little 9.5-10-year-old girl was laying. Go in there and put my head down by her mouth to listen to see if she's breathing, because it's just a matter of time till I beat the living life out of her. Because she loved me. Because she loved me. I don't love me. You can't love me. I attracted all the things I feared the most. I didn't know you can attract the things that you love the most. Yet the alcoholic ego is an unbelievable thing. I remember sitting in my pickup truck 6:37 o'clock in the morning. I'm sitting at a stoplight and I take a hit off a pint of vodka and I look next to me and there's some man sitting there in a nice car. He's got a suit on and tie on and he's obviously one of them lames. You know them lames that's got a job and a family and kids and all that stuff? And he's looking at me take a hit off that pint of vodka in the morning, 6 o'clock in the morning. And I'm looking at him and he's looking at me with that look of contempt. And I take another hit off that jug and I turn to him and I say, "What the hell are you looking at?" See, I got to have a drink just to get to the next stoplight, so I can get to the next stoplight. I'm in the gutter, but I'm looking down on him. I know that I'm the kind of an alcoholic as long as there's one man, woman, child, dog, or cat that'll roll over when I snap my fingers. I won't look at me. I'll step on your back until there's no one to step on. My last drunk lasted 100 days. The last person on the face of the earth to really give a damn about me had died. My old man was drunk and everybody else was gone. My grandfather, my mother's father, died. He's a beautiful man. He lived all his life up in the Texas Panhandle. He was a 32nd degree Mason. He was deacon in the Baptist church. He was a businessman, a beautiful man, and he loved me unconditionally to his last breath. And on his deathbed, he signed a codicil to his will and gave everything he had to my daughter. And he died, and I stood drunk. I stood drunk between a drunken father and a crazy woman that I was married to that day, and it was a cold day up in the Texas Panhandle, and I'm looking at him in that casket, and I'm looking at those people. And they said the last rites, and they handed me a box that had all them little things that you're supposed to fill out and send to all them people, and I spit on that grave and tossed that stuff in there and said, "To hell with you." And I walked out of there and went back to California. And for the next 100 days, I know. They say we seek lower companionship, and when we get to the point that we're drinking with ourselves, you can't get no lower than that. And I lived in a motel room that's one of them cheap kind of motel rooms where there's nobody there but you, and it doesn't make any difference. You shoot holes in the walls, and you yell, and you scream, and you claw at that bed. It doesn't make any difference whether it's day or night. And I know my medicine doesn't work. It's not working. The madness is there. And no matter what time of day or night it is, I can walk in there and look in that mirror and what I see is some insane thing looking back at me. And it ain't working and nothing's happening. And I'm dying, but I can't die, and I'm living and I ain't living. And it's failed me. I know loneliness. I don't think there's anybody that knows loneliness like the alcoholic. Unless maybe it's the family of the alcoholic. We know loneliness. We know that insane loneliness where there is no hope, no place to turn, no place to go. I rolled around in there until there was no skin on my elbows or my knees, and I come out of there wanting to die. There was two different groups of people had a contract on my life, and I walked out of that motel room hoping that they'd blow a hole in me. It was better than what I could handle in there. Unbeknownst to me, they'd pulled their contract because they found out the way I was killing me was much more painful than anything they could think of. And I rolled back home and I got in that house in the last 30 hours or so of my drinking. I stuck everything in me I could stick in me. And it didn't work. It didn't work. Not for 1 second. Not a tenth of a second it didn't work. Through the miracle of Alcoholics Anonymous, little gray-headed man and some prayers, this guy showed up at my front door. Weird little guy. I met him at that front door with a .357 magnum stuck it right in his face. And he did something he's never done before or since. He reached up and took that gun out of my hand, threw it over on the couch, and he said, "Now if you want to commit suicide, you got a crowd. I'll wait." And he followed that by saying, "If you don't ever want to take a drink again as long as you live, you don't have to." And I didn't know how you could go any length of time without something in you. And then he said, "But I'll guarantee you one thing. I'll give you something better. If you don't ever want to be lonely again, as long as you live, you don't have to." And I followed him into the next room just on that simple statement. And he started telling me about a program called Alcoholics Anonymous. And for the first time in my life, I was receptive a little bit. And he took me to a detox, and he put me in an alcoholic detox. And they took me in there, and they took all my clothes off. And they gave me one of them funny rows with no back end and sent me down on one of them cold couches, and all these weird people started coming and talking to me, and man, I'm crazy. And they started coming in there talking to me about the program of Alcoholics Anonymous. And they were asking me stupid questions like, you know, how long did you drink? And I saw 22 years. So good, you'll have to go to a meeting every day for at least 22 years before you can have a night off and go to a movie. You know what I mean? They were weird. And they weren't friendly either. I mean, they said, you got to have a sponsor. I said, what's that? So a sponsor is somebody who gives you guidance and direction so an idiot won't be running your life. And you need a sponsor, one of them hard-hearted sponsors, one of them kind of sponsors that's more concerned for your life than whether you like him or not. And some weird guy come in there and started talking to me about all these steps and all this inventory stuff. And God, and I said, I don't like going to them meetings and churches. You got to sit in them kindergarten chairs and they got all them funny things on the wall and all them crosses, blood running out of them. I don't like God. Don't want anything to do with God. And he said, oh, that's great. There's only one thing you got to know about God. And I said, what's that? And he said, there is one and you ain't him. Oh, I mean, you know. I said, I'm an atheist. He said, good, go get a dictionary. I went and got a dictionary, and I looked up the definition of an atheist. Hell, I didn't even understand it. He said, see there, you're running around saying that you're something you don't even understand. He said, you're an agnostic. I said, oh, okay. I stayed in there for 30 days, and they gave me a big book of Alcoholics Anonymous and kicked in the butt, and I had no place to go. I went back home, ran up that door, knocked on the door. She come to the front door, and I said, I got to go to a meeting of Alcoholics Anonymous every damn day for the rest of my life. What are you going to do? So I've been going to Al-Anon, the kids have been going to Al-Ateen, the dog's been going to Al-Dog, and the cat's been going to Al-Cat. What are you going to do? Well, I don't know. I went and called my sponsor. He said, don't do nothing, I'll come and get you, and he came and got me. We started going to meetings of Alcoholics Anonymous all the time. There's a pitiful, incomprehensible demoralization after you sober up. They want you to go to work. They want you to pay back all this. I owed everybody a dollar, and it was all due. They told me to go home and put my arm around her and tell her I love her. I said, I don't love her. I don't want anything to do with her. I hate her guts. Don't make any difference. Go home. And I went home and she come walking down the hallway. I put my arm around her and she jumped. What's that for? And I said, hell, I don't know. My sponsor told me to do it. Don't ask me. Oh. You know, when you're new, where I live, you got 30 days or less to make you stand up and identify. And the amazing thing about when you're new in Alcoholics Anonymous, we make you stand up when you're 30 days or less sobriety because we want to be saved so we won't embarrass you, but we really want to embarrass you. We really want you to know that we know you don't know shit about shit. And there ain't nothing sicker than a newcomer's God. You're always getting direct messages when you're new. And when you're new 30 days or less, you're very insignificant. There's an amazing thing about the alcoholic ego. When you get 31 days, you become significant. You don't have to stand up anymore, and you know everything. And an amazing thing will happen to you. You clean up a little bit. Start making those amends. I went right down to C&R Clothier and bought $1,000 worth of suits. Now, that's a lot of suits. Turn them inside out, right there, the vest change, everything. Man, I was cool. I was nuts. I don't understand anybody that comes to Alcoholics Anonymous, puts a plug in the jug, and everything's fine, man. You take that stuff away from me, I am crazy. I didn't quit carrying guns because I sobered up. I needed more of them. I had so many of them on me, if you'd have bumped into me, hell, there'd have been a mushroom cloud there. Sometimes they frisked me before they'd let me into some of their meetings. And they come there, keep coming back, sicko. I went to a meeting over in Anaheim Friday night, men stag, craziest bunch of people I ever saw, weird, crazy people. And I'd go in there and there'd some guy be talking in there and I'd listen to him and I could tell, sick as I was, that he ought to die. He's sick. I'd take a gun out of my boot, take a bullet out, take a Pentel pen, write his name right on the bullet while he's sharing, hold it up and say, I'm going to kill you after the meeting. Put the bullet back in the gun, put it back in my boot. Somebody else would talk and it'd be weird, sick stuff coming from them people. I'd do that again. Get three or four of them, put us in the meeting, be over, they'd all stand up, put their arms around me and pray and say, keep coming back. And I'd think, well, I forgot which one I was going to kill first. I'll come back next week and throw a grenade in here. Yeah. They just smile. Tell me to make them amends. I had to go to work, running all around, crazy, going to meetings. I went back to work in the oil field and I was going to all them. First 3 years of my sobriety, I slept in my own home. 61 nights. That saved my marriage. But that's of the apartness in our togetherness. And I'm crazy running around out there trying to make these amends. I owed $265,000 when I sold it up. Nice round number. And some of that was to people that you must pay back, I guarantee you. I didn't know where I was going to get that kind of money. I went to a guy down in Texas who inherited his daddy's land and bank. And he's one of them guys that when we were going to high school, I had a couple of buddies. We went down to the park. I wasn't going to school, but I went down there where they were, and he was a smart-ass little rich kid, and I took his stance down and made him run around in front of the girls. And I had to go apologize to him. My daddy made me go apologize to him. Here I'm a year and a half sober, and he's the only guy I can think of that might loan me this kind of money. And I went and looked him up, and sure enough, he had it. And I told him, I said, I need to borrow some money. Here's why. And I had a bunch of forged papers and every other thing, you know. And I'm telling him I'm sober and Alcoholics Anonymous and I got to pay all this money back. And he said, okay, I'll loan it to you. He said, you remember that day in Dunn's Park when you took my pants down in front of the girl? And I said, yeah. He said, I have never forgotten. He said, I'm going to loan you $265,000, 20% interest. You miss one payment, I'm going to blow you away. You go to work. And resentments are good for some people. They remember them. And I was out there running around crazy. And yet, the alcoholic ego revives itself, irregardless of the length of sobriety, man. I'm 3 years sober, I'm dying inside. I was so dry as a fire hazard running around here, inventorying things and making amends, but I'd say, I'm sorry. I'm sorry. Kind of run around and keep doing it. 3 years sober, I ended up in the hospital bleeding to death because the walls of hate. I'd sit in the back row of a meeting of Alcoholics Anonymous, I think, that's all right for you, I know you feel good, but me, I got to live with me. It's like I had a tattooed on my forehead. You ain't nothing. You ain't never going to be nothing. I was standing around a little club, a little AA club over in Anaheim, in Southern California, one Saturday morning. Had my big AA car parked out front because I wanted them to know I had discovered prosperity. Big Lincoln. Had it parked right in front of the club so the newcomers would have hope. Had my smiling Frankie Gordon suit on, the gun in each boot standing over there in the corner. My sponsor stood on the other side of the room and they'd point at me and say, look at him, 3 years sober without a change of attitude. Ain't he wonderful?
Yeah.
Sit on. Pretty soon a weirdo come walking up to me. Where's the guy you ever saw? What's right up next to me? Honey had on one of them with strawberries and cherries on, had a pair of pants hitting by his knees, a pair of thongs on. He said, I combed my hair. I said, the hell you did. I said, what do you want? And he said, will you be my sponsor? I said, oh, jeez. Here I am doing the best I can. And this weird. I said, all right, I have to ask my sponsor. I'll run over to my sponsor. Does he see that weirdo over there? And he said, yeah. I said, he just asked me to be his sponsor. My sponsor says, I know. I sent him over there. He could have sent a lawyer or a doctor or something, I mean, there is justice here. And he said, no, he's just right for you. You go over and tell him you'll be his sponsor and do what he says. I thought, wait a minute. But then I didn't argue with my sponsor, and I went over and I told that weirdo, I said, my sponsor says I got to be your sponsor. What do you want to do? He said, I want to go for a ride in your Lincoln. Well, he wasn't no idiot. I said, okay, let's go. You go out that door and I'll go out this door. And he says, no, I want to go with you. And he grabbed hold of my arm and started walking. When we got over there at the door, I had two friends. 3 years sober, I had two friends. They stand there by the door. He says, that's my sponsor. And I, Jesus, man. He said, boy, it's going to be fun to watch you two grow. I got him out there in my leg and we start driving around, and he's talking this sick, sick shit, man. And he talks and talks and he says, you ever do anything like that? And I said, yeah, I used to do something like that. And I'd tell him all my stuff and he'd say, man, you're sick, we need a meeting. Like, I'm supposed to be saying that, I'd take him to the meeting, take him home, he'd go in there, I'd come back and get him. He looked like he just stood inside the door waiting on me. I said, why don't you call me Harry? He said, I did. Hell, you did. Get in the meeting, get in that car, go down the road, talk sick, sick stuff. Now, I'm going to tell you something. I grew up on a farm. That's a city boy, and I could always top him in the sex department. I told him I had to quit kissing them sheep on the lips and make amends to herder of cattle, And I had to lie to him a couple of times because you can't never let one of them proteges top you, He told me later, he says, I know you lied to me because some of the things you said you did, it's physically impossible to do. He always rattled all that insane stuff off. And then he'd say, "You ever do anything like that?" And I'd tell him some of my stuff. He's going to meetings. I didn't realize what was going on. I moved out of the old neighborhood. That'll happen to you. Prosperity sets in. You get to doing a lot of things. And moved out of the old neighborhood. Got one of them neighborhoods where you don't let anybody park the car out in front of your house. It's got stickers on it because you don't want your new neighbors to know. No newcomers in the driveway because their car always leaks oil. And Sunday morning, you always read a spiritual book. And I'm sitting in there reading a spiritual book, 3.5 years sober, and come and knock at the front door. Went over to the front door, opened up, there he was, standing in my front door. Weird, boy, weird. Looked like half of his foot was in the concrete. Looked like the other half of him was headed for Tijuana, Mexico. His old car was in my driveway, run 6 quarts of oil out. Time he got to the front door, stickers all over that. Said, Jesus, the neighbors know now. I said, "What do you want?" And he says, "I want to work the steps." And, "Oh, Jesus, get in here quick before my neighbors see." He come in the house and I said, "Well, I know one thing. I'm powerless. I let you in here. My life's unimaginable. Looks like you're going to stay. I know that you're insane, and I understand what the hell you're saying, so we're on step 3. Okay. So I had to get on my knees and do that third step prayer with another alcoholic. He got on his knees right there and said, "Get down here." And I thought, I think I'm supposed to be telling him what to do, but I got down there, opened that book up, you know, and we read that third step prayer together, and he cuddled up underneath my arm. Cat walked by and looked weird at me, and I thought, "Oh, geez, my wife sees me on my knees in the kitchen with this weirdo, she'll know I've flaked out for sure." He jumped up and says, "I want to do my fourth step." I said, "I got you now, sucker. You're supposed to have that done before you get to your sponsor's house." And he said, "No, I can't write." Sit down at that table, took that paper out and threw it across there and pencil, and he started talking. He said, "I'll talk you right." Hell, I started writing. We talked for about an hour and a half. And he said that thing. He said, "Did you ever do anything like that?" And I said, "Yeah, I did." And I started telling him some of my stuff, and I remembered a couple of things I forgot to tell my sponsor when I did my fifth step, and I knew God was in the room, and he couldn't read. Just put some of my shit in his. What the hell? I felt good. Still do. We burn it. You know? Pretty soon he jumped up and ran around and kissed me right on the cheek and said, "I love you." And I said, "Well, it's all over now." Run out in the front yard with that book and Sunday afternoon in front of God and everybody and said, "I love you," and jumped in the old car and went down the street, and I knew the neighbors knew then, for God. But I did something I'd never done before in my entire life. I got out of myself. I was sitting around here dying because I was so in the self. I didn't understand how you could forgive yourself. People would say, "God's forgiven you. Why can't you forgive you?" Because I'm not God. I always had a smart answer. But it is in forgiving that we are forgiven. And that day, that guy sat there in my kitchen and had a couple of little daughters, and he was talking to me about his daughter. And I shared with him about my daughter. And I told him about one day, I don't know what time it was, 6:30, 7 o'clock in the morning, my daughter woke me up Saturday morning. She asked me what I was going to do. That Saturday morning, I said, "I don't know, I'll probably do something AA." She said, "Well, would you come down to this place?" She gave me an address, and she said, "Come down there about 11 o'clock. I went down to this place, big place, big as this. A lot of people in there, and I walked up through the back door and leaned up against the wall. There was a stage up here, and I didn't know what was going on. I wasn't sober all that long. I couldn't be around people, but I leaned up against that wall, and pretty soon they had a bunch of little girls come walking out on the stage, and I didn't know what was happening. But I see my little girl standing up there, and she'd taken 12, 13 bucks and enrolled in the modeling course. And she's going to Alatee, and she had enough self-worth to try to do something. She didn't even tell me or her mother about it until that day. And she was graduating. And I leaned up against that wall back there, and pretty soon I saw a little girl come out on that stage. She had a sparkle in her eye. And there was something special about her I'd never seen before in my entire life. I want to scream out to them people, "Man, if you only knew the kind of animals, if you only knew the kind of people we are, if you knew where that kid come from." I wanted to scream that out with all my voice and all my heart. But I couldn't say nothing. It stuck right here, baby, because you see, I didn't have nothing to do with that. All I've been doing is just going to meetings one day at a time. But I got to lean up against that wall back there and let some of them daddy tears come down. I got to share that with that ding-a-ling, and he told me about his own daughter. He said his own daughter came up. He sobered a little while, and his daughter came up and jumped up in his lap and gave him a little flower. She'd cut out of school, out of paper. And Daddy, I want to give you a flower that'll never die. And hugged him, and he and I sit there. We cried those tears, you know. The macho man tears. Not tears of sorrow, but tears of joy. Because we don't have to act on those insane thoughts. And I had the gratitude of being a sober member of Alcoholics Anonymous, and my little girl made the transition from a young girl to a woman because I didn't have to do the things that I knew I was capable of. I shared that gratitude with that guy. I didn't look down on him because he was what he was. I was equal. I shared my deepest, darkest secrets, and I didn't know what love is. I don't know what love is. People have been telling me they love me all my life. All I knew is if you told me you loved me, I just knew I was next. And yet that day I knew something about love. I know for a guy like me, love is an action. And the first act of love is the act of transparency. I must let you see in, and if I let you see in, what I can do is I can see out to be transparent. I'm as sober as I am secret. I got no secrets. Even the things that are secret to me are not secret to you. And if there are no secrets, there is no gossip. And if there is no gossip, what that means is it's not necessary for me to have every one of your approval in order for me to feel good about me. And I know I have that today, you see, because ever since I got up, man, I've seen them all. From the second I woke up to this second right now, I've seen them all. I've seen the tall ones, the short ones, the rich ones, and the poor ones, man. And from the second I woke up to this second right now, I haven't seen one person that thought of nobody I'd rather be than me. God, that's unbelievable. I look for that feeling, never drink pill or fix it, ever took my entire life. I can walk out there on those streets and I hold my head up with the dignity of a human being. I sell my soul to no one. My book says we crawl before no one. We answer to our God. Sometimes I rationalize and justify because I get afraid and fear is my partner. I know fear. But that day when that guy left my house, I experienced the second great act of love, and that's the apartness in our togetherness. You see, when I shared all my deepest, darkest secrets with him and he left my house, I don't let people leave when they know that about me. I take a hostage. He'll hurt me. And that guy walked out. And he's still sober today, and so am I. And I let him go. And I experienced the apartness in our togetherness. And I know the love, the act of patience to sit there and listen but don't hear. To listen and not judge. To not have a time element on there. And I know a freedom beyond anything I've ever experienced before in my entire life. I thought freedom's doing what the hell you want to do anytime you want to do it. To anyone you want to do it. I thought if I got you laying face down on the floor and a 38 the back of your head and I'm taking your billfold out, I thought I got you. I don't have you. You got me. I know today simply freedom is simply having the strength to do what's necessary to be done when called upon by your fellow man and your God. Not necessarily in that order. I'd like to tell you every day's been a holiday and every meal's been a banquet ever since I walked in here. I've been working with them newcomers and it's just been fantastic, and it has. I had me 11 good years. But I have had me some bad days, baby. And if anybody stands up here at these podiums and tell you they never had a bad day, don't ask them for a ride home. Because the emotional pain of sobriety is so excruciating that it's beyond anything you ever had in your life. You'd be a real alcoholic. You drank and used that stuff to keep from going through those feelings. And I've had me some bad days. And they told me, man, you're going to have some good days. And you file them away because you're going to need them. 9.5 years sober. I stood in front of a judge. 9.5 years sober, he's talking to me about me. He's got the right guy. And I'm standing there in front of him, and he's talking to me about a way of life, a lifestyle of 20 years of my life. And I'm thinking to myself, standing in front of that man, I'm 9.5 years sober. I've been the chairman of a bigger deal than this. I've been chairman of the Southern California Convention. Man, that's the biggest annual convention in Alcoholics Anonymous. It has 163 people on the committee. It runs $240,000 worth of money through the treasurer, and I never stole none of it. I can take you to a meeting of Alcoholics Anonymous where there's at least 50 people in there that I sponsor. I can take you over here and show you this house my wife lives in, and I can show you this beautiful lady and all the good things that she's got. I can take you down here and show you this banker that I paid that money back in 8.5 years. I wrote every check for that. I can take you over here and show you all these people that think I'm wonderful. That's what was going through my mind in 9.5 years sober standing in front of that judge, because I forgot where I come from. The alcoholic ego will revive itself irregardless of the length of sobriety. It will have to be smashed repeatedly in order to have continuous sobriety. And I let my ego overpower my good sense. I walked out of that courtroom, 9.5 years sober. My lawyers told me, there's a 50-50 chance you'll do a minimum of 5 years in the federal penitentiary because of 20 years of involvement with organized crime, a way of life. A way of life. Just because I sobered up didn't mean I quit doing all those things. There's a way of life there that was just much me. When I sobered up, I brought me. I like the deal, man. I like the deal. Cut me in. I don't care if it's 50 cents or 50 million. Deal me in. That's a way of life. I like the action. And then old timers told me, you got to shut the back doors. You never shut the back doors. And I walked out of that courtroom, and they told me it would be 45 days before I had the answer. And I went home. And I watched that lady go to 45 Al-Anon meetings a week, because that's what she'd been doing for 9.5 years, going to 4 to 5 Al-Anon meetings a week. I watched that little girl sit right there on that couch, and I watched them go right back the way they were. I saw the anger come from that lady, and I consumed with guilt, sober. You see, everything in my life had to fail me before I would ask you for help. Everything failed me, and I asked you for help without any condition. At 9.5 years sober, everything in my life failed me, including you, before I would ask my God for help. And that's exactly what it says in the ABCs. There will come a day. There will come a time. There will come a time in your sobriety when you will be faced with that test. Dependent only upon your spiritual condition will you have the strength to make it through that moment. And you will know there will be some power greater than you that has reached down and picked you up, carried you through. And it will only be predicated on your actions that you have taken up until and including that point. I know today that anything less, one phone call, one meeting, 1 second after a meeting of Alcoholics Anonymous, if anything less than what I had done up until including that point in my life and my sobriety, 9.5 years sober, if I would have done anything less, I wouldn't be sober, because I sit there 9.5 years sober with all the humiliation and degradation that I had when I was brand new. And that's exactly why it's so important when you're brand new to remember the feeling. Because if you stay sober, you will experience those feelings of humiliation and degradation as a result of your own actions. And only through that will you be able to recognize your character defects. You see, character defect's not a character defect to me until it causes me pain. It may be driving you nuts, but until it causes me pain, it's not a character defect. And I'd get up in the morning and I'd take a ride to my sponsor's house, 5-6 o'clock in the morning. It takes 20 minutes to get to my sponsor's house, and I'd pull up in front of his house and I'd sit there for a few seconds and I'd reflect on the past 20 minutes, and it's beyond anything I ever imagined how I could go from my house to his house and not stop and get something, stick it in me, because I had waves of fear roll over me. Waves of fear around my throat. And there was old timers in Alcoholics Anonymous who came to me and said, you got what you deserve, sucker. And then, you know, there was old timers in Alcoholics Anonymous that come go with us. They felt that 9.5 years was just as important as 9.5 days. And they shared with me their experiences and their surrenders. Both of those people taught me something. Those people that I sponsored that fired me because they had put me on a pedestal, they'd made me their God. And I'd failed them. Our Peter made us play. And after 45 days, I stood in front of that judge. And he talked to me about me, and he had the right guy. And I knew there was some amends in order. I knew that I was going to have to make some amends, and through a loving God and people, not only people in Alcoholics Anonymous, but other people, I was able to close the back doors. I was able to close the back doors to the point that my way of life is no longer my life. It's my past. It's my experience. I know freedom. I know a spiritual strength beyond anything I ever knew before in my life. I know a feeling of self-worth and dignity, because at 9.5, 10 years sober, I stood in front of people and I said, I'm wrong.
I'm wrong.
I don't like to say I'm wrong. You see, if I say I'm wrong, I got to change. I don't like change. I'm afraid of change. But for me to stand there and say I'm wrong meant that I had to change, and I had to stand in front of people and say I'm wrong. I had to say, please don't judge me. In the sense that you have to judge everybody else. I'm me. But don't let my actions influence your feelings about other people. They're doing the best they can, and I have to change. And I knew I was going to get to stay sober. I knew I was going to get to stay sober. I know beyond a shadow of a doubt there is some power greater than me that works through people, through his example. And yet, you know, it's an unbelievable thing. 50% of the people in this room will die drunk if you be an alcoholic. 50%, maybe more, right now. You know, I heard a story when I was new in the program about Alcoholics Anonymous. I grew up on a little farm up in Texas, Panhandle. I heard a story of a little boy, a little farm boy, and he was standing out there on the farm one day with his daddy, and a man come by. He was a circus man, and he wanted to put a poster up on the side of this barn, because the road went by, and he probably gave the farmer a few bucks, and they put this poster up on the side of this barn. The little boy sat there and watched him put that poster up on the side of that barn. Never seen anything like it in his entire life. He lived on a farm all his life, and there were beautiful animals and beautiful people on that poster. He'd never seen it. Made. He asked his daddy, he said, Daddy, when the circus comes to town, can I go see the circus? And the father, being a good father, said, Son, yes, you bet. You work hard. From time to the circus to go to town, you can go see it. And the little boy worked real hard. And every day he'd go out and look at that poster. And he just couldn't wait to get to town and see the circus. Come the day for the circus to go, and the father gave the little boy 50 cents. And the little boy walked 5 miles to town. When he got to the edge of that town, sure enough, there was the circus. Come in on the train, walking right down through the middle of Main Street, on the way to the other end of town where the big top was. And the little boy was so amazed at the parade, he sat down on the curb there, and there they were, all the beautiful people and all the beautiful animals. Never seen anything like it in his entire life. He was amazed. And the last person in that parade that went by was a clown. The clown tipped his hat, and the little boy flipped his 50-cent piece up into the clown's hat and got up and walked 5 miles back home. And when he got home, his father said, Son, did you see the circus? And the little boy said, Yeah, Daddy, I saw the circus. That's a sad story. You know that? That's not a happy story. He didn't see the circus. He just saw the passing parade. This is a passing parade through here. I don't want to be a sad story. I've been a sad story all my life. I want in that big top, man. I want in there where it's happening. I want in there to take the actions and feel the enthusiasm and the excitement about life. I want to get out there and experience all that. I don't want to cheat myself out of nothing. Today I'm willing to walk that deal. To know the freedom and the strength that I'm supposed to have from the beginning time I walked in here. Now, I had it all wrong. You see, all my life I wanted to be the meanest man on the face of the earth. Man, I knew how to do that. I knew how to have the toys and the costumes and the disguises. I knew how to act. I knew how to be. And I was all wrong. I had to come here. If you want to know what the meanest man on the face of the earth looks like, you're looking at him. He's that little guy who lives down the street and got a wife and a kid and a dog and a cat. And he can get up in the morning, go in there and take a shower and put a clean set of threads on. He can walk in the kitchen, put his arm around his wife and say, Baby, I love you. Hope you have a good day. He can walk across that room and he don't have to kick the dog or the cat. He can put his arm around his kid and say, Baby, I love you. Have a good day. Enjoy your day. And he can walk out and get in that car, go down the street, and he don't have to flip the crosswalk lady off. He can go work with them crap heads all day long at the end of the day and get his pay, come home, lay down and take a nap. Get up and come to a place like this and laugh and cry and kiss him goodbye. It takes guts to do that. Guts. I walked in the doors of Alcoholics Anonymous, some dingling cop punched me like that, and he says, I hear you're a bad dude, Ace. I said, yeah. He said, well, if you're tough, let's see you stay sober. And he wasn't shitting. But I know it takes everything you got and then some. But I know that strength. I know about a God. I don't know a lot of things about a God, but I know I can look back and I can see many things, and I know many feelings. I know many moments. I know many times when it amazed me. I know what it's like to love and to be loved. I know one way to explain my God, and I'll share with you, and I'll shut up. There was a story I heard when I was around here, and it's the only way I know how to depict some of the things. I don't have the words to explain, my God. He's there. I know. I feel it. There was a story about a little cobbler man. A little cobbler man was a beautiful cobbler man, and he died, and he went to heaven, and he was standing in front of God. God said, "Shoemaker, you're a beautiful man. You worked all your life, and you gave your money and all your time to your family and your community. And perfect. Except one thing, you really never believed 100% in God." And the shoemaker said, "Well, you know, God, if I could have just seen you one time, if I could have just seen you once, or maybe if I could have just heard your voice one time, or maybe if I could have just touched you one time, I'd have believed 100%. God said, "Well, you know, shoemaker, you remember one day you were working in your little shop, and you looked out the window, and it was a snowy day, there was snow on the ground, and you looked out, and a little girl was coming down the street, and you went over at the door, and you invited her in, she was cold, and you set her down on your bench there in your shop, and you took her shoes off, and you put your coat around her so she'd warm up, and you noticed there was holes in her shoes. So you took her shoes, and you patched the holes, and you went back and put them on her feet, and you went back to work, and pretty soon you heard a little noise, and you looked up, and the little girl was leaving, and just as she got to the door of your shop, she stopped, and she turned, and she smiled at you." And the cobbler told her, "Yeah, I remember that day." "So, well, you remember one day there was an old bum come down the street and went into your shop, and he wanted some money to get something to eat, and you didn't have any money, took all your money to provide, and but you had 2 sandwiches in a sack, and you told him, you know, if you'll sit down here, you'll share a sandwich with you. Then you sit down next to him, and you gave him one of your sandwiches, and he ate his, and you ate yours, and there was no sound, and no talk, and you got up and went back to work, and pretty soon you heard a noise, and you turned around, and that bum was getting ready to walk out the door, and just as he got over the door, he stuck his hand over there and shook your hand." And the cobbler told God, "Yeah, I remember that." He said, "Well, you remember one day you were working in your shop, and a little old lady came down the street, and she was lost and confused, and she was crying, and you brought her in the shop and calmed her down, and you found out her son was up the street. You went up and got him, brought him down there, and you calmed her down, and you went back to work. And she was getting ready to leave, and she yelled over the counter and said, 'Bless you, my son.'" The cobbler told God, "Yeah, I remember that day." God said, "Well, the little girl's smile was my smile, and that bum's handshake was my touch, and that little old lady's 'Bless you, my son,' was my voice. I was there all the time. You just couldn't see and you couldn't hear. Now, you know, on any given day, if I want to reflect on that little girl, and she's 24 years old, she's not a little girl. She's a professional model. She's in Milan, Italy. Right now, she's self-supporting through her own contribution. And she's daddy's little girl. I don't give a damn what you say. And she's an active member of Al-Anon over there. But last Christmas, she came home to spend Christmas with us. And we sit. My house is in order. And when I took her back to that airport, she's walking down that deal to go on that airplane. And she stopped down there. And she looked at me, and I looked at her, and I knew beyond a shadow of a doubt, if I don't get more than this, I'm overpaid, baby, I'll guarantee you. And if I want to think that's my God smiling at me, I can. And I know my old man. My old man and I hated each other beyond anything I ever knew. And because of this loving program and a loving God, we've been able to put our arms around each other and hold each other like a father and a son. And if I want to believe that's my God's touch, I can. And at 2 o'clock in the morning, I don't know, many, many times I woke up 2 or 3 o'clock in the morning in that house I live in, and that lady lives next to me. That woman put her arms around me and whispered in my ear. And there's a quietness in that house. There's no flesh tearing flesh. There's no insane yelling. There's no crying. There's a quietness. And she says, "Baby, I love you. I love you. If I want to believe that's my God talking to me, I can." And you can say that ain't right, but you can't say I'm wrong because I'm sober. I know that on one dark day, people like you, you welcome me in. If you're new or relatively new, I hope you don't ever have to take a drink again as long as you live. I hope you can come in here and get a little piece of this deal. It's for you. I hope you can enjoy the enthusiasm, and enthusiasm is God within. Enjoy it. Be a part of it. It's yours. It's free. It's free for the taking. I know that I'm very grateful to have a privilege of being here, to share a little piece of me with you. That I might get to stand here, be transparent, that you might be able to look in. And when I let you look in, I can see out. And what I see is the sparkle in your eye. What I hear is the laughter and the healing medicine of that laughter, and what I feel is your touch. I'm overpaid. And yet I enjoy it. Because I'm part of it. Be a part of your own sobriety. Be a part of life. Enjoy yourself. Enjoy this moment. We don't have no other time. We've got this moment right now. You can enjoy it. God bless. Thank you. Yeah.